Speaker, and I am going to ask Senator Dahl to guide us into the conversation. And if Senator Nino comes, he will chair also part of the committee. Senator Dahl will direct the meeting now.
Well, welcome to the committee, Ms. Dugan, and I know that we've had a chance to visit in our office. As you know, Senator Torres-Reyes asked me to be kind of a point person on assessments, and so we've had quite a few meetings with a number of people, many of whom already testified before us on how important our assessments are for many reasons, whether it's diagnostic purposes to determine career readiness, college readiness. We've got even professional growth among teachers, so that we know that assessments do a lot of things. We appreciate you sharing your expertise with us today, and we will allow you to begin. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rose Herman, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. Jennifer Dugan is our Director of Assessment. She will be giving you a quick overview, and we will be joined as soon as he arrives by Matt Mose, who is one of the co-chairs for the assessment work group, and I will be available to answer questions as well. So with that, I'll turn over to Jennifer Dugan.
Thank you. Ms. Dugan?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. When we were preparing the presentation, we decided to start at a very fundamental level and make sure that I don't slip into assessment lingo. And so I will try my hardest not to do that. So please interrupt me if I break into that. Okay, so a general overview of Minnesota assessments. The Minnesota assessments that are created at the Department of Education, and Dr. Heisted talked briefly about these last week, they are summative assessments. And so those assessments are administered at the end of a predetermined period of time. And so customarily that's at the end of the school year, and that's approximately when the testing window is for the entire state. Minnesota assessments are also criterion referenced assessments. And why that's so important is because the assessments that we create for Minnesota students to take are customized specific to the Minnesota academic standards. So last week there was a lot of conversation about what is going on in the classroom, what are teachers teaching. The Minnesota assessments are assessing just that. Because Minnesota teachers are teaching the Minnesota academic standards, the Minnesota assessments are aligned exclusively to those Minnesota academic standards. Also want to echo something that was said last week, and I believe it was from Dr. Heisted, that what's the most important assessment that's going on is the day-to-day formative assessment that teachers are doing. That's the most important assessment, because that tells the teacher, again, where students are in the mastery of those Minnesota academic standards so that the teach and the reteach can be applied. So just wanted to echo that. The testing requirements, both federal and state, the Minnesota's tests are aligned to Minnesota academic standards. And so all students are assessed on those Minnesota academic standards. That does look different depending on the subject and the grade level. So for mathematics, all students are assessed annually in grades 3 through 8, and then once in high school. And in language arts, in Minnesota, we assess reading. We don't assess the entire language arts spectrum. We just assess the reading part of that. Again, that's 3 through 8, and then once in high school. And then science is once in the elementary, once in the middle school, and then once in high school. And again, that's for all students. The tests, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but the tests look different. And there was also a comment last week about sufficient notice and feeling as though there was shifts in the assessment program and there wasn't enough notice. And I wanted to make sure that it was clear that when the Minnesota academic standards are adopted by the legislature and then the benchmarks are put into rule, at that time, it's announced when the assessments are going to roll out to assess that curriculum. So, for example, the Minnesota standards in math were adopted in 2007, but the assessment aligned to those standards didn't roll out until 2011. So there was a lot of lead time for educators to make sure that their curriculum was ramped up and aligned, again, to those Minnesota academic standards. And again, federal and state statutes also require testing aligned to the academic standards for English language development. And so these assessments are only for English learners. And so that there are four domains, and it's reading, writing, listening, and speaking. But again, it's in grades K through 12, but it is all English learners must take those. And then a state-only requirement are the graduation tests. Minnesota operationalizes the graduation test requirement for Minnesota in written composition, reading, and then mathematics. But those are only in state statute. So what does this look like for an individual student? So each year, again, if a student is in grade 3, for example, so there's a lot of tests up on the slide, but if it's a grade 3 student, they are assessed in math and assessed in reading. And if they are a grade 3 English learner, then they would be assessed in English proficiency assessment as well. Conversely, if I was a high school student taking biology, I would be assessed in, let's say I'm in grade 10, then I would only be assessed on grade 10 reading. Also, my high school science, if I'm taking that biology because it's an end of instruction piece. And so it looks different for individual students, even though there's a lot of different tests listed there. Keeping with the look of what a student sees, we want to make sure that the assessment is appropriate for the population. So there are different populations in Minnesota. The test that's administered to most students is the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. And so that has a math, a reading, and a science component. But again, that's about 98% of the students, I believe, take the MCA or an accommodation with MCA. And then there are also, going to the other end of the spectrum, the Minnesota Test of Academic Skills are the assessments developed in math, reading, and science for the most severely cognitively challenged students. So these assessments are administered in an individual administration, and it's administered by the teacher that knows the student the best, because these students frequently have communication specific to their needs. And so you want the person that knows best how they are indicating their response to be administering the test. So those are administered one-on-one. They are still, again, aligned to those Minnesota academic standards. Those students still need to be instructed in those standards. And then there's an MCA modified, which is developed for special education students. And so there was a bit of talk last week about what about students that are low performing and have a lot of difficulty with instruction. The MCA modified is an attempt to bridge that on the assessment aspect. So it's for special education students that are persistently low performing, and it's only in math and reading. It's only available in math and reading. But it's for students that are persistently low performing, which means that in grade, if they are a grade 5 student, then on the grade 3 and the grade 4 MCA, they scored in the lowest achievement level. So for 2 years, they scored in the lowest achievement level, and their special education, and they have a standards-based IEP aligned to those Minnesota academic standards, then they're eligible to take that MCA modified. It is the MCA modified does utilize some practices in universal design that are being adopted into the development of the MCAs. So last week there was a comment about the reading load within a math problem and not wanting that to be a confounding variable. We've tried very hard to adopt those principles in developing the assessments. So at one point we did have a specific math test for English learners that was it used very simplified language. It was administered on the computer, and there was audio available for the students. Those principles are now adopted in the design of the MCA. If a school chooses to administer the MCA online, all students have audio available to them, not just English learners. So if they're a low reader, or if they get confused, for example, with parallel and perpendicular when they see it written, but when they hear it, it's a different cue. All students now have that option in the online administration to have the audio available. So those are just a few examples of where we're incorporating that design in the development of the test to better all students' performance and most accurately measure their knowledge. The language proficiency tests are referred to as the ACCESS for ELLs. And again, that's the reading, writing, listening, and speaking component. So all students that are English learners take all four of those components. And the administration of that does vary. And then the graduation required assessment for diploma, that is the graduation component that is specific for Minnesota. So it has that written composition, reading, and math component to it. And again, we've talked about the assessments aligned to the standards, and so that is the system check. All of those tests that we just talked about are system checks to let teachers know how effective their instruction is about the student's mastery of those standards, so that can impact the system conversations about maybe different approaches to a particular concept if students aren't performing well. You may wonder where some of the scores are used, and I'm sure that this is not an exhaustive list, but the ESEA flexibility waiver utilizes the math and reading assessment scores for all students, and it is not just, I believe you've seen presentations about the multiple measures rating calculations. It doesn't look at strict proficiency, and Dr. Heisted referenced that last week about the 100% proficient by 2014. That's no longer our goal. We're looking to close the achievement gap. And so, Minnesota growth is also calculated using those assessment scores. And then QComp and the potential in the future of incorporating it in teacher and principal evaluation. So that's a few places where the scores are used, and I'm sure the districts use them in many more ways as well. Would you prefer that I pause here? That was a lot of information. I can pause before I go on to the historical piece with graduation.
Any members have any questions at this time? We'll allow you to proceed. Thank you.
Okay, this is more of background of the graduation assessment requirement piece. So several years ago, the basic skills test was the graduation test for Minnesota. And the reason that I italicized basic requirement is that it's very important to understand while all of these were graduation requirement assessments, the rigor and the content knowledge needed is different on the BST, and it is increased when you go to the grad. So I wanted to make sure that was clear, that the BST truly was a basic skills test, and it was first administered in reading and math in grade 8, and then students had retake opportunities after that, and then the writing component was first administered in grade 10. And then, again, in 2005, legislation replaced the BST with grad. So then the grad was developed. The conversations started around the state roughly development in our division, at least, started back in 2004. And then students that were in grade 8 in 2005-2006 are under the grad rule. And so you'll hear those. It's all based on when a student first entered 8th grade is what's important there. And so their requirements are that they must demonstrate mastery of skills needed for success in the 21st century. And so that assessment is aligned to the grade 11 math, grade 10 reading and written composition, and grade 9. It is important. So when the grad was first administered, it was initially administered embedded within the MCA for a variety of reasons, and a lot of that had to do with stakeholder input of motivation of students and not wanting to have more tests. And so for the MCA development, the grad has overlap with those standards. So the MCA 2 and the grad were embedded in the initial administration. That is not the case with MCA 3. And so what that means is, as we are aligning the assessments to new standards, this year will be the first year for reading that MCA 3 will be operational, and then math grade 11 next year will be the first year that that is operational for MCA 3. So again, as those are being rolled out this year for reading, aligned to those 2010 standards, and next year in high school, aligned to the 2007 math standards, that grad component is no longer embedded in the administration because there's not an overlap. There's not as much of an overlap with the standards from the 2003 and to the 2007 with the grad test. Because of that, it would have lengthened, in order to add that on, it would have lengthened the test so drastically that we feared that there would be test fatigue for students. And so a student will still be able to be meets or exceeds on their MCA, MCA modified, or MTAS, and still satisfy their graduation requirement. That piece. And the alternate pathway, in 2009, students that were in the graduating classes of 2010 to 2014, roughly speaking as cohorts, an alternate pathway was created for those students if they were not able to pass the math grad. So all students are required to still have a passing score on the written composition grad and still have a passing score on the reading grad. The alternate pathway only applies to math grad, but a student must complete all four of the components, the coursework, all other credits, and then remediation, and then the number of retests.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dugan. Are there any questions from the members?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have a chart that's got different colored diamonds on. I think this is a real quick summary of what Jennifer just shared with you, and it kind of puts it in a, you know, one pager. There's also a sheet, I think, that was handed out that gives you some terminology and some basic tests. I know, as you mentioned earlier, it does get to be terminology heavy, and it's important that you do understand the terminology. She mentioned, like, meets or exceeds. We have standards as to when students are labeled as proficient, and there's like four categories, so there's other detail that she's not shared, and if you come across some of that terminology when you're talking to people, we'll be happy to try to clarify.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dugan, if I remember correctly, when we were talking about the MCA 3s as it relates to evaluation, can you let us know if the MCA 3s are going to provide actionable data or real-time data, whereas you know how the old MCA was, you had to basically wait like till the next year to figure out. And then is the MCA 3 going to be administered, if I remember correctly, it's going to be administered multiple times instead of the same year to measure progress. Is that correct? Am I remembering that right?
Ms. Dugan?
Thank you, Chair. Senators, so I'll take that in two pieces. The first piece is, and I'll talk about the current year, during the testing window, which is the beginning of March to the middle of May, for MCA math, 3 through 8, because those are the operational assessments that have immediate scores. So those, if a school decides to test online, then the student's score is available for a teacher immediately. It's up to the school whether they choose to administer on paper or online. Is the data actionable for a particular teacher? So they would have my student level information about what my individual performance was, and then also how I performed within the subcategories of those standards. So for math, how did I do in number sense? How did I do in geometry? But then also, if I am a teacher, let's say that I was a seventh grade math teacher, so I can look at, and I could look at my first period class of my pre-algebra students, and I can get all the way down to the benchmark level of how did my pre-algebra students do, and let's hope that they did really well on pre-algebra and performed well on that algebra strand. But I can get all the way down to the benchmark to figure out, well, how did they do in geometry? How did they do in probability? I can look at those specific benchmarks. That information is not available because the online test, Dr. Heistad talked about this too, the online math test is changing as the student responds. So let's just say that you were a classroom, all of you would essentially have a different test based upon your response pattern. So if I was your teacher, then I could look at, that's how I can get down to that benchmark level. That is only available if my school chose to test online. If my school decided to test on paper, they only have that strand level information because you all took exactly the same test. So I don't have as rich information to provide to you in a reliable, valid way. That said, I don't have it today. I actually left a meeting at the department where we were talking about providing more detailed information to the teachers, to curriculum leaders, both for science and math, as the new assessments are rolled out, that teachers are finding that is more actionable. And so it's not as far as we want to go, but we're figuring out how to get there and how to share that information with the teachers as quickly as possible. And again, those math scores are available online immediately. Going to the piece about the multiple opportunities, the MCA is only available as an accountability score. In 2013, there's only one opportunity per student for an accountability score. There is an additional window that districts can choose to avail themselves of that is the optional local purpose assessment, and that is an online assessment in math 3 through 8, and it provides immediate results, and each student has up to 2 opportunities. So this year that window opened October 1st, and it closes February 2nd. So some districts tested early in the fall, and they're testing again in January and to see what progress students have been made. Some districts said, we're not going to do the fall. We're going to wait until January, and we definitely saw that bear it out in the numbers. I think this morning's numbers, that optional local purpose assessment, over 260,000 students in 3 through 8 have tested since October 1st. That's individual tests, so that's possible that there's overlap there, that again with the 2 opportunities per student, but it's over 260,000 administrations. So that's the first year we've rolled that out and had that as an option for districts. Overall, I think the districts have found that to be helpful information. I think they're waiting to really let us know if it was helpful based upon how they perform in the spring and to see if remediation was effective. But they're all, again, that optional local purpose assessment is all Minnesota items, and they were MCA items, they're developed exclusively for Minnesota, aligned to those Minnesota academic standards. So again, everything is aligned to the instruction that's going on specifically in a Minnesota classroom. Get it all?
Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions from the members? All right, we'll move on. And obviously, our assessment system isn't perfect. And I think that's kind of the next step here is having the co-chair, Matt Mose, explain a little bit about the report, the Commissioner's Assessment and Accountability Working Group report. And again, I've had the pleasure to visit with you briefly and appreciate your work on the report. And go ahead, introduce yourself to the committee, and we'll let you have the next however long you need.
Okay. Thank you, Senators. My name is Matthew Mose. I'm the Chief Academic Officer for the St. Paul Public Schools. I am also here representing the working group that the Commissioner called together for assessment and accountability. I was one of the co-chairs, and we met starting last summer in beginning late June, and continued our work through November with the hopes of bringing forward a series of recommendations that might offer some guidance from the perspective of multiple stakeholders, educators, members of the public, business representatives, higher ed institutions, to get a handle around what's going on in our state around assessment and accountability. And I guess, you know, I've been involved in this conversation now for 15 years in various forms as we've as a state had to deal with both melding state desires with federal desires and federal mandates and looking at the ways in which our assessment systems sometimes have driven other conversations. And I know that the charge that the commissioner gave our working group to address does come from some of the comments that the commissioners made and the governors made around concerns about the role of assessment, the amount of assessment that students are experiencing, and certainly from a local district perspective, I really believe that we've gone a little overboard on the assessment side, to the point where essentially we have students since winter break, since we returned at the beginning of January when you all returned, we have assessments going on now until the end of the school year. And some of that is based on our own choices because the tools available to us are not fully at the level of depth that we would desire, and so we have to seek out other tools. And a lot of these are also the mandates that are placed upon us. And so when you look at this from a student's perspective, if you put yourself in the seat in a classroom and think about the number of opportunities that a child is experiencing assessment, it's probably out of balance with what value the results are providing to the educators. And so we, as a working group, really took that to heart. But one of the things that we didn't limit ourselves to, and I'm sure probably somewhat frustrating for you, is that we didn't limit ourselves to existing statute and to the mandates that are out there. Because essentially, if you look at the existing requirements, in some ways they're an evolution over a large number of years and lots of fingers in the pot stirring it. And at the end of the day, maybe it's not, if we had actively created the system 15 years ago, we probably wouldn't be where we are today if it, by design, but we're where we are. And so we wanted to really look at how can assessment support where we want to go as an education system and moving forward. So because our subgroup was so large, our working group was so large, we divided into three subcommittees. One was to look at elementary and middle school assessment issues. One was to look at essentially high school transition and the broader concept of college and career readiness. And then the third subgroup was responsible for specifically looking at the grad requirement, because we know, as Ms. Dugan referenced, that the grad requirement with this alternative pathway that sunsetted, and now we essentially have two groups of students in our high schools. Moving forward, we have half of our students who are subject to the alternative pathway option and the grad in reading and writing, and we have another half of students who are now progressing under the statute with the sunsetted alternative path pathway or the lack of an alternative pathway and a somewhat incoherent, unclear future as to what's going on around that. Obviously, existing statute suggests that the passing all three grads is the expectation, but I think there are some concerns that have been continually raised about whether or not that's the appropriate policy to still have in place moving forward, given the goals that we want to try to accomplish. And so when we put forward the recommendations, some of these recommendations are essentially fairly low-hanging fruit, very easy kind of recommendations. I'm not presenting them in the numerical order that they're in the report, but all 11 recommendations are covered in this. So I will make reference to the number as I go through it. And so, again, this first recommendation that our assessment system should be transparent, easy for teachers, students, parents, and the public to understand, allow for multiple measures, and provide timely results to support instructional and curricular needs is not an earth-shattering recommendation. You would hope that the assessments that we offer our students and require our students to take offer a lot of value. But we did want to make sure that it was clear that the assessment results are primarily, or assessments are primarily a tool to get us to an end and not an end of themselves. And so we wanted to make sure that we recognized the various groups that use the results from the assessments and what their primary purpose is, which is to support the education of our students. And so wanting to support the instructional and curricular needs first and foremost. The second recommendation is that we wanted to, which is recommendation number 10 in the report, is that we want our assessments to have certain characteristics. That we do like the fact that Minnesota has been moving in the direction of having assessments that are available online because it's the only way to get the results that are immediately available to educators, parents, and students. But there is a significant infrastructure cost that goes along with being able to do that. And so there are some trade-offs that are very significant associated with it. We also want the assessments to be robust enough that they have a diagnostic component to it. So essentially an assessment that's a survey or a sampling of content, it might not, and that's the only option that's available, is not something that educators can always use for actionable information. So we need to have diagnostic elements built into it. And then we want to make sure that the assessments have the highest psychometric quality possible, so that the scores that are given are representative of what we're asking it to measure. On our third recommendation as being presented, it's actually recommendation number 8, is that we still do want to have assessments that offer multiple measures that are tied to a proficiency standard, grade level or college readiness or whatever we might define proficiency around, but also has the ability to measure growth for students, because we know that students aren't coming to school with the same level of preparation, and we have numbers of students who are coming in sideways across the state, and we want to be able to provide them with a pathway towards proficiency.
Very well. Thanks.
The next recommendation is that, obviously, with Minnesota somewhat going its own way in terms of the Common Core, that our assessments need to be aligned to Minnesota standards, and that they need to be consistent with Minnesota's college entrance requirements, and that we also need to make sure that our assessments are measuring college readiness standards. And there are a number of studies out there that have started to show what college readiness, how you operationalize college readiness in terms of an assessment score. When you look at the 3 through 7, so we typically have a tendency to talk about assessment as 3 through 8 in high school, because that's the way the federal government somewhat broke it down for No Child Left Behind. We actually see value in talking about assessment as a 3-7 cluster, and then looking at 8th grade really as the beginning part of the conversation around college and career readiness. So our recommendations were clustered around that. And our recommendation for grades 3 through 7, which is recommendation number 6 in the report, is making sure that the system has a series of characteristics that include the diagnostic and adaptive capabilities of an assessment that will help measure the full spectrum of performance of students that aren't just sensitive around the proficiency cut, but are sensitive across the full range of performance, that they're anchored in Minnesota's standards, that they are predictive of the trajectory for college and career readiness. The journey to college and career readiness starts the day that students come to our schools, and even starts before then. And so we want the assessments to be predictive, not essentially, I guess, fatalistic. So it's not that you can't change the trajectory, but you do want to know what path you're on at any given level of performance. And we certainly want the results to be able to measure growth as well as proficiency. In the areas of early assessment, recommendation number 5 did suggest that the state could play a role in looking at appropriate preschool and kindergarten readiness assessments, early literacy assessments. Given the fact that we have so many different educational entities in the state, a lot of school districts are making individual choices around this, and it's not always necessarily anchored in full information. And so it's a lot of duplicated effort. And if the state could really be assisting districts, this probably wouldn't be something that we'd look at a mandate from the state on, but having the ability to have the state provide guidance to districts and recommendations around how to assess early literacy skills in particular, tied to the Read Well by Third Grade initiative, and leaving that to the purview of local districts would certainly make some sense. So that recommendation was added in there. Recommendations 4 and 3 are probably the ones that are going to get the most discussion, or hopefully the most discussion this session. I guess that's up to you all. We are looking at recommendations 4 and 3 being around the 8 through 12 assessment and what the state could move towards to really promote college and career readiness. I know you all have spent some time with the commissioner and Chancellor Rosenstone, and you've heard about the early college program and just the promise that this concept of universal college readiness and career readiness offers to really change the game for folks. And our assessments, our working group saw that the assessments are a tool to that, to support that end. And so one of those pieces is that we should have the assessments that have a career interest and some strengths-based approach that are available to students, so that as they begin that transition into high school, they have an idea of what their interests are, so that they can take advantage of the various opportunities that might be available to them, and to start thinking about what do I need to accomplish over the course of the next 4 years and beyond, because high school graduation clearly isn't going to be the stopping point for the vast majority of our students moving forward. And obviously, probably the only recommendation that we needed to take a vote on so that people could dissent was on recommendation number 3. It did pass with a 26-2 vote, so it was fairly highly accepted by the committee, but there was some dissent. We are recommending, working group recommended to the commissioner that the entire grad requirement be repealed. So not just the math test, but looking at the reading and writing assessments as well. And that we really replace the system with a much more rigorous assessment, suite of assessments that are tied to college and career readiness. And that the accountability then rests in terms of both public transparency and reporting, along with the fact that you are building a system to support students' movement towards some form of post-secondary work or entry into a career field. And so we recommended that this suite of assessments begin in eighth grade, measuring reading, writing, language arts, and possibly science, depending on how that were to go along. And we already have done a fair amount of that in the state. The legislature obviously has supported the Explore and the Plan test in the past. We don't have universal ACT, as some other states have moved towards. And our recommendation was very careful not to say that we just want to recommend the EPASS system, but we are recommending a suite of assessments that have characteristics that are like that. We understand the limitations that you have in terms of single source requirements and naming things in legislation. And so what we were really concerned about were the characteristics of what assessments provide to students, provide to families, and provide to educators. And it is something that making sure that there's consistency and coherence across that 8 through 12 spectrum.
Mr. Mose, I think we had a question. Senator Nelson, did you have a question still?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, actually back a few slides, about the recommendation about the career interest inventory to be administered in 8th or 9th grade. I was just trying to recollect, and I think we're looking it up here. It sounds a lot like, or maybe you can tell me the difference between this and the legislation that we passed last session. Was one of the Governor's Workforce Development Council recommendations from their All Hands on Deck college and career planning path. And I'm just wondering, what's the difference between that and this new proposal here?
Ms. Hermanson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I guess I'd have to do some checking on that. I'm not familiar with it. It was in the another committee, I'm assuming, but we can get back to you. But the idea is that we start having kids look at their end game and give some idea to the teacher and our assessment and our parents what things they have, what kind of skill levels they have to have, and take the appropriate courses in high school and stuff. But we can check and see what kind of overlap that might have. But generally, the committee felt we need to start having kids think about their long-term goals and then have parents know and have some way of assessing what skill sets they're going to need and how we get them there before they graduate from high school.
Senator Nelson.
I appreciate you checking to make sure that we're not being redundant, because I do believe this is what we did in the GWDC that we passed in legislation last year out of the Education Committee. So I'll be getting that too, but certainly it's a worthy goal, and we must do that. I just want to make sure we aren't being duplicative.
And Senator Nelson, we appreciate that. Well, it's not our intent to be duplicative. The committee really basically wanted to combine this with the assessment portfolio so that we made sure whether we use something that already exists or develop something else. I think that's the idea, is how we pair these together.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Clausen? Senator Clausen.
Yes, thank you. Along with that discussion about interest inventories, was there any discussion about actually implementing a careers course? My experience has been that many times in administering inventories, there's no follow-up, or it's difficult to find time in the school day to work with students on that career interest.
Mr. Mose.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clausen, we did not actually discuss specific curricular recommendations, and it's partly because of the time frame we were on and just trying to address the assessment side. We had a lot of groundwork to lay early in the first few months to get everyone on the same page in terms of comfort level with just the terminology, as Ms. Dugan was demonstrating for you all, can sometimes be pretty technical. And then the second piece is that we wanted to be careful to stay true to our charge, which was really focusing on the assessment side. So it's not to say that it wouldn't have come up if we were still to have continued meeting, but we really tried to stay focused on our core mission that we were asked to cover.
Thank you.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Mose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess before I proceed, I do want, I guess I will make the, in reference to Senator Nelson's question, some of these pieces are things that we are doing, and we made the recommendation to make sure that it wasn't, that we didn't lose it in the sense of moving forward. So we, in any place where we can build on existing work, and the recommendations are associated with, these are essentially principles or characteristics that we valued for the assessment system. And so there could be multiple paths to accomplishing this, provided that the coherence and consistency is really at the heart of it. So again, in that spirit, recommendation number 7 around how the state has to, should continue to participate in NAEP to provide a measure of achievement comparable across states. We currently don't have a choice in that matter. It's mandated by No Child Left Behind, and districts are mandated to participate if they're sampled. So, I mean, it's, again, a fairly low-hanging recommendation. But should it ever become optional, the committee, the working group saw value in continued participation in that, as well as in the various international benchmarking studies that occasionally the legislature supports with appropriations to allow for our state to participate, and seeing value in those connections, just that we have those benchmarks that are available from outside of our own boundaries. The last two recommendations, recommendation number 9 is that Minnesota should continue to examine the Common Core standards and the assessments that are being developed as part of the state's ongoing standards review cycle. Obviously, with the PARC and Smarter Balance assessments under development and not quite yet implemented, Minnesota is one of two states that's actually administering an assessment statewide that reflects the Common Core. So, at least Common Core in reading language arts. And so we are actually ahead of the game in that front. And as the country moves forward with the implementation of Common Core and mathematics and whatever might happen in the Common Core movement, there we just should remain in tune with that. I think that as a state, we have taken a position on mathematics, and we just certainly want to make sure that that remains to be the right one for all of our students. And then finally, recommendation number 11 was that we encourage the Minnesota Department of Ed and the Office of Higher Education to continue to collaborate on the statewide longitudinal education data system and being able to provide certain kinds of reports that can help inform policymakers and educators and parents about what's happening, and particularly the connection between K-12 and higher ed.
Are there any questions for Mr. Mose from the membership? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions with respect to resources. It seems to me that clearly as we embark in the conversation about, you know, what do we do with our system and what needs to stay in place and what needs to go, we need to talk about resources. And the task force talk about not having the infrastructure to really do this. So my question is related to who doesn't have the infrastructure. It is my understanding that the bulk of what we give the department today in terms of resources goes to this division, and I would like to have perhaps Ms. Herman or Ms. Dugan to talk about. There is, I see that there is a difference between infrastructure that needs to be in place to handle these recommendations at the district level versus the department level. I presume that when we talk about infrastructure needs, we are talking about providing resources to the districts and not to MDE. But please correct me if I am wrong.
Ms. Hermanson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, yes to perhaps both. It depends on what we come out. If we go to adopt a new suite of assessments, I think we'd have to find out what the cost of that would be at the high school if we have the testing, this comprehensive package, because right now we are doing the MCAs, and Ms. Dugan can probably help you on the cost factors because she works with the bidding and the RFPs that go forward. In the end, do we keep the MCAs or do we replace them with something else? It will take some development, or we may have to decide about purchasing something. So that's kind of an unknown at this point, depending on what we decide in the long term is what we want to do. Number two, the resources, if we go to online adaptive diagnostic testing, one of the complaints we hear from districts frequently is that their computer labs and their computers are tied up a great deal and they're unusable And so if we go to more online testing, yes, I'm assuming that districts would need resources in the lines of the technology to help them do that in a manner that allows them to have technology for other instructional purposes during the school day. So there is some unknown depending on what we decide we want to do for the future. We know that ACT are developing a suite of assessments. We also met with the College Board, which is the SAT. Do we develop our own? All of that will be the end result of what we decide in relationship to these recommendations. And so I can't give you a more definitive answer than that. Perhaps Ms. Dugan might want to add about what cost factors they do in RFP. We have commitments now in relationship to the development of MCAs and how that works. But the potential exists for additional costs, or there may be savings. We don't know yet, because I have seen some tentative documentation that says we might be able to save some money if we buy a prepared suite, but that's going to depend on what we want in the long term.
Thank you.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the question about the computer facilities and doing that, one of the things that I've heard in local school districts is that there would be a real opportunity if buildings could do things on a wireless basis, and that right now there's a limitation in place that makes it impossible for them to do that. I don't know if that's something you can address right now or if that's a question we can look at moving forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not a technology person, but as I watch my grandkids and other kids go through the computer technology, you barely catch up to speed on one and you have to get ready for the next wave. But bandwidth is an issue, potentially in outstate areas, just even access, and whether we have a lot of schools going to iPad technology. What is the technology that we would use or the school districts would want to use? Fundamentally, I think right now, I'm not sure, I'm assuming we're doing them on regular land-based landline computers, the current assessment system, whether there's opportunities for others yet, I think we'd have to explore that.
We Mr. do Mose? Support, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ms. Dugan.
Senator, we do support wireless testing with the current contractor, and that is something that the previous contractor did not support. Some districts were successful even with the previous contractor, even though it wasn't listed as a permitted administration mode. They were still able to administer wirelessly, but the current vendor does support wireless testing, and so many districts have moved to the computers on wheels. So,
and if I can just follow up with a
Senator
quick
Kent.
Comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, as things are evolving, obviously it's hard to always stay ahead of things, but we keep hearing about the limitations of those specific hardwired rooms in our buildings, and if we can work around that, that just seems to be kind of common sense as we move forward. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Mr. Mose had a comment.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Kent. One of the things that we're encountering in St. Paul, and obviously we do have the benefit of being in the capital city and access to certain infrastructure that might not be available out in greater Minnesota, but we are still finding that wireless bandwidth is a fixed capacity, and that we have to be very careful in terms of when we're scheduling and how we're scheduling the assessments and what has to become a priority. And we're looking at our bandwidth needs just within the next 5 years tripling, and that we're still going to have to look at some sort of metering that takes place. And so from that perspective and their infrastructure needs within the buildings in terms of wireless access nodes, and we get very technical conversations around this. And so while the flexibility of wireless administration is something that we strongly desire, it is going to come with a number of issues for access. And again, part of the overall concept of these broader recommendations was trying to get balance back into the system in terms of assessment, so that when you invest the time and resources into the assessment, that it's going to be the most valuable use of it, as opposed to essentially monopolizing our computer resources for the majority of the school year. And so that's why we still want computer-based assessments, because of the benefits they offer, recognizing that the resource limitations are a significant factor that can't be overlooked.
Well, I would just like to say, if there's any other questions, we can get to those in a second. I just want to say I'm really impressed with the work of the working group on this on assessments and accountability. I think, as you may know, the challenge is how much can we do in this particular year? I do believe that this should be a kind of a guideline for us going forward. And the people that I'm talking to, and I've talked to many of this impressive list of people that were on that committee already, and I will continue to talk to them. I've talked to many of you members as well. But what can we bite off in this short term that really needs fixing now, in also looking to the long-term recommendations of this particular task force? So that's the challenge before us. And as you know, time is already slipping away. But we do have a plan. I'm talking with some House members as well on which direction they would like to go with this particular task force, or the short-term needs that many of you have shared already. So I'm optimistic that we can get started on this particular a good piece of legislation going forward. But please, members, anyone in the room, I'm certainly will be talking to all three of you yet. Please contact me in my office as we work very quickly in the next week or week and a half to get a piece of legislation together. So are there any other questions? Senator Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I was out of the room for the last point here, and I'm particularly interested in SLEDs. And it's an issue that I'm working on actually right now. Do you have – I agree with this entire point. Do you have any specific recommendations as to how best you think that can happen? Because I would say that it's not necessarily happening right now to the extent that we need it to. Was there any deeper conversation about that point?
Ms. Hermanson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, our co-chair, Fred Nolan, was the one who had the committee. They actually had presentation from SLEDS and delved into that somewhat more in detail than the committee I worked with, which is elementary, and the one that Matt worked with, which was the grad. I think the concern is that we continue down the road with the department and higher ed working on ways and of keeping this going and finding what's the most efficient and best uses. There are several things under discussion at the department about how we might best use this system. But our deputy commissioner, Jesse Montano, would be the most knowledgeable and has worked in the greatest depth with this. In fact, we're trying to put a data analytics component in our department to help us figure out what all and how all we might use this information. So it's kind of – we're working on it. We got some things to discuss, in particular as it relates to such things as teacher and principal evaluation. There's a lot of things under discussion, but more depth details at this point are recommendations we don't have.
And just, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Moss.
Senator Peterson, one of the things that I think, again, we offered a couple of specifics in the full report about types of reporting that would be useful, I think, on both ends of the spectrum. But I think one of the elements that we look at is that it is difficult to really get a handle on information around how our students do after they leave us. And in essence, from a high school perspective, and I'm pretty sure Mr. Gengler probably mentioned this to you as well from Irondale, that one of our true measures of success as a K-12 system is really how well the students are prepared for the next level. And so looking at being able to have access to much more robust information about that and being able to use that as part of our ongoing improvement cycles is going to be important. And the systems are starting to come into line for us to get that information more fully. And so I think that that's what we were trying to capture here, is that we want that constant flow of dialogue between the systems and what the data are showing us in terms of how well we're doing in terms of the preparation for that next stage.
Okay. Well, we are going to move on. If you have any other questions, I'm sure you know where they work. And they'd be glad to hear from you. We do want to hear from Jane Burnett. Thanks again for your testimony. Is Jane Burnett here for Minneapolis Public Schools, please? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself. And
my name is Jane Burnett. I am a social worker in the Minneapolis Public Schools. And I work with students ages 3 to 11. All of the students that I work with receive special education services. And I'm here to talk about what I see high-stakes testing doing to my school community, to students and teachers in particular. I don't have a PowerPoint or any handouts, but I did bring a Valentine that was made by one of my fifth grade students in our social skills group today. And the topic was sharing, you know, sharing compliments, sharing love, sharing ideas, and sharing glue sticks. And she wrote this. This is a student who lives with a foster family after being removed from her home by child protection. She made the Valentine for Miss Ann, who is our on-site therapist from a local mental health clinic, who has an office in our school, is in our school practically full-time. She has worked with this student for almost a year, and they meet weekly for sessions in her office. The student was, when she was removed from the home, she was placed in she was in residential hospitalization for mental health trauma. And this is what she wrote. Dear Miss Ann, I am so, so glad that I am back at school. You are a great person to me and to others. We enjoy you being with us. You are great for the girls. Thank you for that happy birthday card you sent me. You are great. You do a great job. I love you. So that's just sort of the one part, a bookend for my presentation. What I see with students at my school, the fifth graders take 7 standardized tests plus 5 sampler or practice tests during the year. They have to prepare not for just one test, but for one right after the other. Our testing coordinator told me today that they've counted up that fifth graders take at a minimum 12 hours of testing during the school year. A few students finish a little faster than that, but most of them take longer. And students with special education needs have accommodations that allow them to break the test into small parts, to leave their classrooms and come back on a different day to retake. So what that means also is that in a mixed grade class like my special ed classes with students with emotional and behavior disorders, a third, fourth, and fifth grade class, students are missing more than just on the one day that the fifth graders take the test. We often have days where only part of the classroom is together. The social workers end up working with students who have difficulty or stress with test taking, issues of test anxiety, feelings of incompetence. Students don't necessarily name the issue. They can't say, I have test anxiety, but we see it manifested in a lot of different behaviors, like getting upset and angry during the test, throwing a test booklet, breaking pencils, walking out, kids who don't come to school on the days that they have tests, or who go to the health office with stomach aches or headaches, students who say they're purposely going to do poorly on the test because I hate this stupid school, and they hate it because of the test. One Minneapolis social worker recently who works with fourth and fifth grade students shared this story. She went into some classrooms to talk with the kids about testing. She asked if they feel they're tested too much. Every single kid raised their hand and said yes. Of course, that was a sort of loaded question, the way she phrased it. But then she asked, how many of you worry about testing, either before or during or after the tests? And many of them raised their hands again. And some of them wanted to get into a much longer discussion about testing. One fourth grade boy said, and he had tears in his eyes when he said it, I worry that if I don't get a good score, I won't get a good job or be able to go to college. And some kids said, it makes me nervous and worried when other kids get done before I get done. And I I did talk with my son, who's an adult now, but I had to go in and sit with him during second grade when he first took whatever test it was back then, because he refused to go to school unless I came in with him. And I phoned him when I knew I was going to be coming here, and I asked him what he remembered about the big tests when he was in school. He said, well, I didn't get real stressed out when I had those tests. I'd just break out in a sweat and get lightheaded. Other kids had real breakdowns when they had to take them. He said, like Sam, he ran out of time on the test, and he said he had a breakdown right in school because he was so worried that he wouldn't get into college. That was in sixth grade. So he also said there are better ways to show what you know. But that he used to feel bad about himself because of his test scores, that he thought he wasn't very smart. A volunteer called me this morning saying she had materials to drop off for my art activities, and I said I wouldn't be at school when she could come by because I was coming here to talk about testing. She's 40, and she said, oh, my God, testing. I used to shut down completely and forget everything I know. I could hear the stress in her voice just thinking back to when she used to go to testing. Teachers report that when students are tested on computer, they become so overwhelmed because they'll see the number of questions they have to answer, that they freeze up. They don't comprehend the questions because of the way they're phrased. They might know the answer, they might know the material, but they can't answer the question because of the way it's put to them. They have a hard time concentrating on the split screen with text on one side and questions on the other half, and they don't match up. And the teachers have to stand there and watch the dejection on the faces of their students. The students will look at them with a look like, help me. And the teachers can't step in and help them. So it damages relationships between teachers and students for you to not be able to step in and help your student when they need it. Not to give the answer, but even just, you know, to comfort them or calm them. Students also get discouraged when they get back their test scores and their score hasn't gone up or has even gone down. Some of them just become angrier about a process that makes them feel, once again, that they're not good enough. One teacher told me of a really smart student who just hated taking tests. So she would just go click, 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 click right through the answers without reading the questions. She just wanted to get it done. And I'm afraid that we may be creating hostile test takers. And this is a big one. Many of our students have other things on their minds. My school has a really high percentage of students who are homeless or highly mobile. Students didn't have a good night's sleep, or they're wondering where they're going to sleep tonight. Their parents were fighting, or they share a room with an older sibling who's up late playing video games. They don't get supper. They don't have clothes, including socks or underwear, in weather like today or like last week. They don't wake up in time to catch the bus, so they have poor attendance. And it makes it really hard for them, first of all, to be learning, and secondly, to be taking tests. For students who have related services in special education like speech language or occupational therapy, they have set minutes each week that they're supposed to see their clinicians, but frequently the testing disrupts that schedule, so they're missing out on things that are documented that they are required to have from their IEPs. And I question what we're testing. Even with value-added ways of scoring, are we looking at the fact that students don't know the material because of external factors like homelessness, race, ethnicity, or being an English language learner? Or is it that they don't perform well on tests because of external and internal emotional factors? And I know that some of what I've described might just sound like anecdotal, emotional, nightmare scenarios, but they're real for my students. They're the reality that they live with, and that's true for a lot of the students throughout this state. And I'm sure that if we're looking at the whole issue of the effect of test anxiety and the effects of other stressors on students and testing, the State Department of Education could provide us with that, could provide this committee with it to look at. When I asked my teachers and teachers that I've known who've left the public schools to go to charter schools, teachers who've retired, teachers at buildings where I used to work, every single teacher said the same two things. Standardized testing creates so much stress for students and teachers, and they would like to see more resources go towards emotional behavior and mental health support for children and families. And these are some quotes. The stress comes from the very top, from the Department of Education to superintendent to principals to teachers. And when I'm stressed, it affects my students. I try not to bring it into the classroom, but I know that I'm not always successful at that. Team meetings and professional development sessions used to be places to get refreshed and excited about my teaching. We used to talk about interdisciplinary units or building good relationships or how to address behavior. Now they almost all focus on reading and math data, test scores, how to improve test scores, and so they just add to the stress and feeling of being overwhelmed. Professional development isn't as collegial as it used to be. Before, the whole building staff was involved, and now with the focus on teaching reading and math, meetings aren't as relevant to people like me. One year I had to learn how to teach writing. It was a requirement from the state legislature, but they changed the law a year or two later, and I no longer have to learn how to teach writing. But our specialists like art, Phi-Ed, Chinese, music, and media teachers also are not part of the data-driven professional development sessions. And teachers are worried that the meetings are about data instead of the whole child. They're worried that if we're going to tie teacher evaluation to test scores, what do we do about the teacher who volunteers to have the students with the most challenging behavior in her room? The entire class can suffer because of several or even one student who is disruptive. But someone has to teach those students. And are we going to punish the people who step forward to say, I will take them? High-stakes testing results don't show the big picture of what our schools are like or what the lives of our students are like. The mental health needs of our students are very great, and many of them don't have all the tools they need to be successful in general, and we just focus on how well they take tests. Morale is going down. I just have to say this. 5 years ago when I started at my current school, I loved going to work every day because of the atmosphere in the building. It's changed. Instead of being like this, teachers are like this. Yeah, I note it every year. They're exhausted physically and mentally, and they feel like they aren't being effective because of testing. Teaching used to be a joyful thing, but now there's less and less teacher choice about how to cover the curriculum. Everyone's in lockstep doing the same thing. That was from a teacher who left Minneapolis Public Schools to go teach in a charter school. We have been spending money to hire test coordinators, for spending money on computers and for testing. And it's not just a question of spending the money on computers. We also lose a room when we have to set up a new computer lab for testing. I lost a room that I would use for groups. I don't get to have as many group sessions for social skills or behavior because we no longer have the room that was that we could use for that. Then the bookend for this. I got an email from a teacher, walked by the room. It's a challenging classroom. It's in a federal setting 3 classroom for emotional behavior disorders. And she said this, "What I saw was amazing today. Those kids who are always struggling, screaming, frustrated, were so on task. And what were they doing? Gluing Valentines. Who says creativity is bad? I honestly believe if we could all teach an art activity every week and display our products, there would be a lot more peace in the building and fewer behaviors. All of this testing is hurting our kids and the creative juices and their self-esteem." So to summarize, this is my sense of what's happened to public education since the increased emphasis on testing. The dedication, the teachers still have the dedication, but the joy is gone.
Thank you, Ms. Burnett, for your excellent testimony, and appreciate your time today. I think we'll turn it over. We have a couple of bills on hot lunch. I hope you all ate. Senator Carlson, did you have a question or comment?
I do, actually, before the department.
Or Nelson, sorry.
That's okay. Before the department actually leaves, I did want to ask about one of their recommendations.
Senator Torres Ray, do we have time? I know we have two bills we wanted to get in. Could you contact them directly, perhaps?
Yes, I can do that.
Okay, sorry. We've got a couple of bills we've got to try to get. Thank you.
Hi there.
Thank you, members. Again, I want to make sure that you remember that we have chairs of working committees that will be attentive to your calls and will be entertaining conversations and figuring out how they can help you incorporate some of your ideas and input into that. Senator Dahl will be looking at assessment and testing. Senator Clausen will be dealing with teacher evaluation. Senators Halverson and Franson will be, we will have a hearing on early childhood education next, and then they will be leading our conversations on early childhood. And then Senator Kent Senator Peterson and Senator Clausen will be doing the evaluation. And then Senator Nelson is going to be also joining the group for early childhood. And then Senator Kent and Senator Rood will be leading the conversations for the higher ed. We're going to move into, I see the department seating. I think we're okay. We're going to move into the third part of the agenda, actually the fifth. And we have the senators here. Thank you so much for your patience, Senator Huffman and Senator Hayden. We are delighted that you're here. Welcome to our committee. And we would like you to proceed together, and we are going to call the testifiers in the order that they are listed in the agenda. But we wanted to give you, Senator Huffman, the opportunity to present the bill, Senate File 38, and then Senator Hayden to proceed to speak about Senate File 146. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name for the record is Senator John Huffman, and I'm honored to be sitting next to Senator Hayden. And Senator Hayden, I want to say for the next 3.5 hours, we're going to be engaging in a deep conversation that at least everybody's looking at us now, Senator Hayden, right? So two important bills, the one that Jerry Newton and I dropped. Jerry Newton is from the House, Senate File 38. Goes back to 2004 when Denise Dietrich got elected into the legislature and I filled her school board seat in 2005. We heard a report on just the free and reduced. And at the time, Anoka-Hennepin School District was at about 22% free and reduced. Now we're at about 42% free and reduced. But still the numbers were there, and it was enough to bring caution to us, saying that we know what research says regarding when it's testing time, everybody gets a breakfast, everybody gets a lunch, everybody gets a snack. We need to level the playing field here. And so what you have is Senate File 38 is really looking at that reduced side of reimbursement increases in appropriation. And you'll hear testifiers from Jessica Webster, who's a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and then Allison Bradford, who's a child nutrition programs director at Anoka-Hennepin School District, who's been in this field for a number of years and has led the effort and you'll hear the numbers, the 41,000-plus students that she feeds on a daily basis. And then along with her is the Cynthia Hiltz, who's the health services coordinator for the Anoka-Hennepin, actually a director for the Anoka-Hennepin School District, and is the current executive member of the National Association of School Nurses, the director from Minnesota, and sits on the National Executive Board. So, Senator Hayden.
Well, good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Huffman. I have the, essentially the same bill. It's Senate File 146. I, along with just kind of monitoring this over the years, was brought this issue and this legislation by Mazone, which is a Jewish response to hunger, a national hunger group that's working with Jewish congregations in Minnesota, as well as other faith-based groups to address hunger issues. They address specifically the issues of students eligible for reduced lunch whose parents cannot afford the 40 cents a day that's required. Across the state, school districts have different policies on how to handle this. Some school districts find funds to maintain a no-turnaway policy. Some provide an alternative lunch, or an alternate lunch, such as a cheese sandwich, and some will refuse providing any lunch after repeated attempts to collect the money their parents don't have. For kids who get an alternate or no lunch, this can be embarrassing and hunger. We can all agree that hungry children can't learn. We make a significant investment in our education, so let's make our kids, so let's make sure our kids are ready to learn each and every afternoon. Senator Hoffman and I have the same bill because we both recognize this need, and that we have a number of individuals representing a wide variety of groups here to support this legislation. And so I know that we are pushing for time, so I won't go on, but I do want to reiterate that I just think that turning children away for school lunch, or differentiating them with a bag lunch or a lunch that is not as nutritious, really flies in the face of all of the great work that I think that we have been doing here today. But I don't think there's any matter of technology or learning or curriculum or test anxiety and all the things I've learned in the education committee today as I've waited. I don't think that that really means anything if a child is hungry. So that's why we're here, and I think we can start with our testifiers. And Madam Chair, if that's your pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Senators. And we, if you wish to stay at the table or however you want to do it, we're going to call three people at a time, and then we will open for questions, and we can call you back. Jessica Webster, Allison Bradford, and Cynthia Hiltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And I'm here because I want to provide a little bit more of the background and lay the groundwork for this issue. Some of you may not know that school districts turn children away or give cheese sandwiches or peanut butter sandwiches. Legal Aid, I found out about this about 5 years ago. We found out that kids were who were coming to the lunch counter and didn't have money for lunch were getting crackers and milk or a peanut butter sandwich or a cheese sandwich. And we were really disturbed by it. We thought it was stigmatizing. But then we learned, actually, those cheese sandwiches and peanut butter sandwiches are a good thing, because we have districts that turn children away with nothing. And I've been up here 5 years now trying to get legislators to pay attention to this issue. And frankly, legislators just haven't believed us. They haven't believed us that it's a real issue and that it's really happening and that anybody would turn a child away. So about a year and a half ago, we partnered with four private law firms downtown Minneapolis to survey as many school districts as we could. And we got to almost 200 school districts. I provided a packet, a summary of the lunch survey project that Legal Aid worked on in your packet. And what we found is that about 20% of school districts do turn children away with nothing. Those policies look different in different districts. Sometimes they let children run a school lunch debt for a week, 2 weeks, maybe a month, and then they turn children away. In a very limited number of school districts, it's day one. They will turn you away. And it varies. I'm talking about elementary school, junior high, and high school, where we've seen these turnaway policies. And then the school lunch research also turned up some really ugly practices, turned up things like where staffers were very honest with us, where they said they're trying to deter children from showing up for lunch and not bringing money. So they do things like issue purple cards, red cards, rubber bands on hands. They stamp hands. And for middle-class families, middle-class kids, it's not a big deal. These things are reminders. But if you're always the kid that has the rubber band or the purple ticket, it's embarrassing. Also things like making a child walk to the back of the kitchen to get a brown bag cheese sandwich and then walk all the way to the front of the kitchen and pass all of their friends. And the staff are explaining that that's a really good deterrent because they'll never come without lunch money again because it's so embarrassing. We found one instance where a staffer actually took a tray from a child that didn't have money, scraped the lunch into the trash in front of them and turned them away. And that was in Aiken. So what I have before you, the summary, I'm wrapping up, but what we did find in our research was there are 22 districts that don't do this, that provide unlimited hot lunches to children. Anoka Hennepin is one of these. Minneapolis is now one of these. They don't turn children away, at least not when we did our research. And so we think it can be done. But then you also have the list of the places that do turn away. So just in closing, I'll leave you with one thing, and that's that Minnesota Public Radio did do a story on this last week, and there were two nutritionists interviewed. And the first nutritionist was from St. James, and she said, yes, we do have a turnaway policy. She said, the pressures on us are unbearable. I have to be in the black. And we did turn away two children last year. And then the second nutrition director, who was from Brooklyn Center, said, yes, the pressures are unbearable. We have to be in the black. And I would rather lose my job than turn a child away. So that's what it looks like. These pressures that are coming down on these school nutritionists are unbearable, and it's unfair to put them in the middle. But at the same time, we just have to stop turning children away. And that's why I support these bills.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bradford.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Excuse me, Ms. Bradford. Ms. Webster, if you could stay at the table in case we have questions for you, I appreciate that. Ms. Bradford.
Hi, thank you for having me here today. The Anoka-Hennepin Child Nutrition Program is a fiscally responsible program serving approximately 5.5 million nutritious lunch and breakfast meals per school year. 35% of our students qualify for free and reduced price meals, and approximately 430,000 reduced price lunch meals are served per school year at a price of 40 cents per lunch. On average, 77% of our students qualifying for reduced price school meals participate in the program and consume a meal each day. This bill would help support the 23% of the students that aren't currently participating in the program and also help the families that are currently trying to pay their bill, the 40 cents for their meals, that are struggling and can't pay. For the record, Jessica really made this sound like we're dumping meals in the garbage as, school lunch as a whole. And we're not ogres. I just want to, for the record, say that school lunch folks are some of the kindest folks you're going to find in the schools. And we aren't treating students like they're second-class citizens. So I just want to make that statement. We're very compassionate with our students. And in Anoka-Hennepin, we are not turning students away. We are, providing students with the school lunch when they come without money. At the high school level, we do have a guideline that we will provide one lunch and then remind the student to bring their money the next day. If they do see our supervisor, we do make special considerations for the student privately and try to not take that tray away, but we work with our students at the high school level because they have enough cognitive ability at that point that they can remember to bring money for their lunch, but we do kind of stretch that guideline depending on a case-by-case basis with our high school students and, work fairly with them. But at the elementary and middle school level, we don't take a tray away from our students. So that's how we handle it in Anoka-Hennepin. But each school district handles, the situation on a case-by-case basis. But we're able to assist our students in our school district because we run an efficient program and can afford to do that. We don't advertise it, though. So we handle it internally. Thank you.
Ms. Bradford, thank you. Could you please introduce yourself again and tell us the school that you represent? We didn't get that on the record.
On the record, I'm Allison Bradford, and I'm the Child Nutrition Programs Director for Anoka-Hennepin Schools.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Hiltz, if you could introduce yourself and tell us who you represent.
I will do that, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Cindy Hiltz, and I'm the Health Service Coordinator for Anoka-Hennepin Schools. And in everybody else's mind, I'm the lead school nurse in the district, so it gives you an idea of what a Health Service Coordinator position would be. I'm here today to talk about nutrition and academic success from the view of a school nurse. So as you know, most children spend a large portion of their day at school. The school is a key setting to implement strategies to address healthy eating habits. The school can provide a healthy environment that supports balanced nutrition and activity. We know that healthy students are better learners, as has been said earlier today. School nurses work as a public health worker, and they develop youth-related wellness policies. We understand the importance of making healthy food choices. Proper nutrition is important in enhancing learning and increasing brain function. I'm going to share just a few highlights with regards to nutrition and brain function. According to the American Society for Neurochemistry, nutrition affects brain chemistry in humans. Everyone experiences the fact that food and nutrition alter your mood and behavior. The neurochemical mechanisms of how diet alters brain function is becoming more clear as the research progresses. The brain is sensitive to changes in the diet.
It depends on a continuous supply of nutrients from the blood. Those which cannot be synthesized in our system at all are essential components that must be furnished in the diet. These essential nutrients include vitamins, amino acids, and fatty acids. Studies of deficiencies of vitamins and other nutrients and elements, such as iodine, provide important insights into understanding brain metabolism. Nutrition can alter your brain function in short-term time frames, for example, by altering neurotransmitters and neuronal firing, and in the long term, such as changing the membrane in the brain structure. Studies of severe protein calorie nutrition in children have a long history and are by far the most common of any nutritional studies that we have. They have reliably found that malnourished children have abnormal electrical activity in the brain, reduced activity levels, and impaired attention. A variety of other behavioral consequences have frequently been reported, including impaired or delayed mental, particularly verbal, and motor development, reduced academic performance, hyperactivity, apathy, withdrawal, and impaired social skills. In addition, we know that children who have poor health are 7 times more likely to miss 11 or more days of school a year due to illness or injury than children in good health. An ongoing series of experimental studies has repeatedly shown that eating a high-carbohydrate, low-protein meal on an empty stomach increases the relative availability of amino acids, tryptophan, and promotes synthesis of a neurotransmitter, serotonin. Under these conditions, several behavioral effects have been consistently observed. Again, we're seeing impaired attention, slowed reaction time, increased fatigue and sleepiness, and then reduced pain sensitivity. Epidemiological studies provide evidence of the role that modifiable risk factors play in many chronic diseases. While, as school nurses and our Department of Human Services has noted, there is less disease in the United States due to infectious agents than there once was, there is more disease related to industrial, technological, and lifestyle changes. The Surgeon General has estimated that perhaps 50% of premature death and disability is related to unhealthy behaviors. These would include lack of healthy diet and lack of physical exercise. The common denominator in the leading causes of morbidity and mortality in the United States is unhealthy lifestyle behaviors, behaviors that can be modified. In school nursing and in several other areas that work in schools, psychologists specifically and social workers and teachers, we learn about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which tells us that we cannot move up that hierarchy until the needs at the lower levels are met. So food and health, which are at the very bottom of the pyramid, need to be met before problem solving can be effective and learning can occur. Critical thinking skills are necessary to be able to learn more complex operations. Healthy diets are difficult to provide when there are a lack of finances. Vegetables and fruits are more expensive than carbohydrates. Our brains must be properly fed in order to function at their top capacity. Therefore, the conclusion that our children require good nutrition every day can be based on this evidence that I just briefly talked about. As a school nurse, I would urge you to reduce as many barriers as possible to provide good nutrition every day to every child. For these reasons I have just stated, I recommend that you pass Senate File 38 and Senate File 146. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions for this group? Senator Johnson and then Senator Chamberlain. Okay, Senator Chamberlain.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the testimony. It's an issue that needs to be addressed. You all made some great points. And I don't know who could answer this question. We're addressing this back end side of it, and I agree with that. But someone up there that can address the application process, I'm just not a whole really familiar with the application process for the free and reduced lunch and how we go through that, how we get to this point.
Each school year there's a new application, and families are mailed the application from each school district. I can speak on behalf of our school district. We have an application that each household receives in the school district. They aren't targeted to any specific family. Every single family receives that application. We also have the application online, so a family can fill it out there. And then the reduced level of, you know, qualification based on how many members are in the family, the income guidelines are provided with the application. And so that gives the family an idea of whether they would qualify based on the reduced guidelines. And then the family fills that out. They can turn it in pretty much anywhere in the school district or mail it back or drop it off at our office. Okay. They can also go online. They're provided that information.
All right, thanks. One follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chamberlain. Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, one follow-up. Is there any point where that information that you get back, is that checked and verified? Is it audited at any point? Where
there is a verification. Yes, okay. There is a verification process, and in our school district, we verify 3% of the applications, and families have to send in their income information based on W-2 or, you know, the tax information.
Right. Is that one last one, and I'll quit.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that varies from district to district. Your district does a random sampling of 3% to check.
Right.
Does that vary from district to district then?
Most districts verify 3%.
Okay. Thank you.
It's a federal requirement.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Ms. Bradford, I understand, too, that we actually don't get responses from people who actually qualify, but they don't turn in the form. I understand that that's an issue. We might have to ask the department for that question, but I understand that there are many families who actually qualify, but they never fill out the paperwork.
Madam
Chair. Is that
correct? Madam Chair, that is correct. Some families fail to apply. That is always something that all school districts are working on. And usually districts as a whole work together, principals, administration, the whole district works on that. It is tied to compensatory aid for school districts, so the district, everybody works together on gathering free and reduced information. It's tied to all kinds of funding for school districts, so we're kind of the first stop, and then we all work together to help families. The main thing is to help families because of all the funding is associated with it for the family.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I'm assuming these have fiscal impacts. I'm assuming the intent here is to take action, and if they pass, to send them over to the Finance Committee.
That is correct, Senator Nino. So they will be referred to the Finance Committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Madam Chair, then, when the questions are done, I do have an amendment I would like to offer.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Any other questions?
Question, Madam
Senator
Chair?
Senator Kent, and then... Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bradford, I was interested in what you said about that you don't advertise this. Can mm-hmm. you speak a little bit more? Because I know one of the questions that always comes up on this issue is a fear of abuse, that suddenly there does become a free lunch. Could you talk about how you handle that in your district?
Ms. Bradford.
Providing the meals when the students don't have money in their account?
And, yes, and working with families and mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Yeah. We have a hard working class population in our school district, and what we do is work with families, sending them reminders. We also have a phone calling system that calls the families once a week to remind them to send in their money. That's our most effective method, actually. And our families, for the most part, want to send in the money to pay for their school lunch. So they're really honest people that we have in our school district for the most part. And we just help them remember. We send home slips each week with the kids. You know, we don't want to hassle families in our school district, but, you know, we let the kids know. And, you know, it's not like we're shaking down kids for money or anything. It's just, you know, trying to work with the parents, not really the student, but the parents. It's the parents that are responsible for their students. But does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. I'm sure there are many different arrangements made around districts.
Yes.
An elementary principal that I used to work with used to make a distinction that adult problems shouldn't interfere with children's mm-hmm. learning, and this reminds mm-hmm. me of that. You know, mm-hmm. It's not the kids' fault, and I'm just curious how mm-hmm. districts are handling these adult mm-hmm. issues in a way that do not
yeah.
increase or provide a negative impact on the learning environment
right.
for the students.
Our focus is with the parent.
Thank you.
Senator Clausen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification, as I understand the bill and what you're advocating for, is that we would actually no longer consider reduced meal service. It would all be, if they qualify, it would all be free. Okay. I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Klassen, the answer to that question is yes.
Senator Hoffman. Okay. Yes, thank you. Senator Wieger.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was out for a few minutes talking to a group, and if you covered this, I'll catch up. But there's a lot of food that's wasted, and we also have a serious problem in our country on obesity. There's been a lot done. Can you address strategies as it relates to making sure people have food, but also on the other side that we have a lot that's thrown away in schools as well, and too much consumption? So it's a dilemma.
Maybe Ms. Hiltz can help us with that question.
Well, I can try. So obesity, having enough food or having too much food is a really difficult discussion to have. If you don't eat regularly, your stomach is hungry, and sometimes you fill it up with not-so-nutritious food. And so eating a well-balanced meal with all of the components, especially the fiber included in it, is extremely important for children and adults too. But at the same time, our kids are learning, so we're trying to change behaviors or make behaviors that will be lifelong for them. So we have to give them a little bit of a choice on what they choose and what they eat. Allison has talked with me before about as the children get older, there are more choices for them to make so that they can learn those behaviors. And I think that is an important part of our nutritional system in our schools. It doesn't answer the question, though, why do kids take food and then throw it away? Are they running out of time? Did they start visiting with their friends too much? Did they suddenly decide they were full before they finished their meal? I don't know that answer. I know that schools are working on various different ways to recycle food, to maybe feed animals instead. That's just one that sticks in my mind. Allison could probably speak to it more.
Thank you. We have six more testifiers, members, so I would like to move. Thank you so much to the three of you. I was thinking about splitting the following group so that we get the kids together, but I was advised not to because we would like to have them next to the adults. So I am going to call the next group, Mr. Samuel Chu, Mr. Mark Miesga, and then we have a fifth grader who is coming with this group, Mr. Talmud Torah. I don't know if he's here.
Madam Chair, I'm not the fifth grader, but
I was going to say
a long time ago.
I don't know what's going on.
But we actually, if it would be the chair's pleasure, we have two young men that testify together. If that would be okay,
that's what I thought. Good. But okay. Since we provided, apparently media asked us for this agenda, I was asked not to split them. But I really wanted to do that, so I'm going to call Sarah Nelson Pallmeyer to be part of this group. And then we have the boys together. That would be great. Thank you so much for coming to our committee. Please proceed. Start with your name and the agency that you represent.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for taking the time. And my name is Samuel Chu. I am the national synagogue organizer for Mazon, the Jewish Response to Hunger. And I know that I look more Chinese than Jewish. I realize that. And so just to clarify for the record that I do represent and work for the Jewish Response to Hunger. This is an initiative that I want to first thank Senator Hayden and Senator Hoffman for their work and leadership on this particular issue. Mazon is an organization, national organization, that is dedicated to reducing hunger. And we work with about 950 synagogues and about 300 secular religious agencies that works on the issue of hunger nationally here in this country. And many of them are here in Minnesota. And I want to acknowledge that many of them are here in this room. Our co-chair for our advocacy effort here, Judy Tenenbaum and Scott Grayson, are in the room as well as about 20 of our representative members from synagogues and organizations across the state of Minnesota. And I think that part of what we are hoping and what we have worked hard to do is that we think that the time is now for us to address this particular gap that is not just a nutrition or hunger gap, but it's an achievement gap in our schools. And that it's important that we tie those together because this is the roots of foundation for all the investment that we make in education in the state of Minnesota in the school that we have. And the reason why we came together as Mazon and our community here in Minnesota on this particular work is because we believe that it has to be a communal response, a collaborative effort that includes every part and every group of stakeholders and leaders to address this. And there's three particular ways that why this is a communal response, and we believe that Senate Files 146 is that kind of solution, is that one, this is a targeted solution. That we recognize that the state and the schools are under tremendous pressure for budget and financial resources, even though lunch programs are funded federally. So we have crafted a solution that looks at targeting specifically families who are making up to $42,000 a year for a family of four. And that's a very specific population to make sure that they are not turned away when they cannot make the copayment by essentially taking away the copayment that they are responsible for. But it is a very specific, again, it's not an open-ended, unfunded mandate. We wanted to make sure that the solution is targeted so that we are being good steward of the money that the state is investing. Secondly, is that we also believe that this is not about blaming, and we know that feeding our children, educating our children requires everybody around the table and all hands on deck. And so I want to acknowledge that Ms. Bradford, who just testified previously, about the fact that it's important that we strengthen as much as possible our school nutrition program at every turn and every possible opportunity. And so this is one of the things that we want to make sure we do in this bill 146, is that we really empower our school districts to have the resources to do their work. We that empower our nutritionists to be able to do their core mission to feed our children instead of being bill collectors, to be able to do that work with the full support of the community. And finally, we believe this is really an issue that is owned by and responsible. Everybody is responsible. That the communities that are sitting around this table and in this room, that the Jewish community here in Minnesota believes that we have a part in making sure that we address this issue and supporting our educators, our nutritionists, and our elected official to have the best targeted, supportive solution to closing the gap of lunch and achievement for our students. And that for the 61,000 or so students that falls under the reduced gap, we want to make sure that hungry kids are fed a healthy meal and that they can do their best and that all the other efforts on top of that that we invest in educations have the desired effects because they are fed and that they have the support of everybody and all the adults that you will hear and all the children you will hear testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Chu. Let's hear from Mr. Miazga,
I believe I am.
Please. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Mark Miazga. I'm a research coordinator at the University of Minnesota with a focus on health research, both at the university and previously at the Wilder Research Center in St. Paul. Cindy Hilton, who testified previously, covered some of what I was going to say, so in the interest of brevity, I've tried to eliminate those pieces. I'm going to focus on two areas today. The first is the research around hunger in children, and the second is the costs associated with hungry children. The research around children and adolescents who are hungry is conclusive. Both research done here and nationally shows that hungry kids are more likely to be sick. They're also more likely to get more severe types of sicknesses and to be sicker for longer periods of time. These children miss more school. They are more likely to struggle with mental illness and emotional problems. They're more likely to be suspended from school. They're more likely to repeat a grade. And finally, they're more likely to fall behind their peers, not only physically and socially, but cognitively, setting themselves up for a pretty tough adulthood. The long-term effects of even moderate hunger in children often carry over into their adulthood. Research shows that adults who experience hunger as children have lower levels of educational and technical skill attainment, which brings down the competitiveness level of the United States workforce. Now, researchers across the country are well aware of these short-term and long-term effects of hunger on children and adults. And for these reasons alone, I encourage you to support this bill. However, there is a second reason to pass this bill, and that is the economic cost of hunger, both in America and here in Minnesota. Research done at Georgetown University, the University of Chicago, Northwestern University, and other organizations shows that hungry kids are more likely to have behavior problems. They're more likely to engage in delinquent behavior. They're more likely to be involved with police departments, sheriff's departments, and the criminal justice system as a whole. They're also more likely to engage in substance abuse and to need health care services, including hospitalizations. According to economic cost estimates published in the Journal of Nutrition and the New York Academy of Sciences, the average daily cost of hospitalization is $12,000 for a child's stay in the hospital. Additional costs beyond these include the added staff time of those employed in law enforcement, the criminal justice system, and school districts, as well as costs to citizens, property owners, and small business people associated with property damage, loitering, shoplifting, and other delinquency crimes. These already cost Minnesota a great deal of money. Passing this bill can help cut down on these expenses while also increasing the likelihood that kids currently on reduced lunch will be productive citizens as adults. I urge you to pass this bill and fill in the nutritional funding gap to help ensure Minnesota meets the needs of its children while also keeping a responsible eye on its finances. I'm happy to answer any questions or provide additional information, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the members? All right. Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer, please proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Sarah Nelson-Pallmeyer, and I'm the director of Minnesota Food Share, a program of the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches. I'm also a parent with three adult daughters who are all products of the Minneapolis public school system. Minnesota Food Share is best known for running the March campaign, a statewide month-long effort to raise food and funds for the nearly 300 food shelves throughout Minnesota. We're gearing up for this year's March campaign, which will begin in less than 3 weeks. Last year's effort raised the equivalent of over 38 million pounds of food for the food shelves, which unfortunately have seen a vast increase in usage, 164% increase since 2000. And even last year, as the economy began to improve, there was still a 1% increase in visits to food shelves. The food shelves need our help again, and we, along with thousands of Minnesotans from congregations, corporations, civic groups, school groups, and as well as individuals, will respond. What I'm here to say, though, is despite this large statewide volunteer and nonprofit effort, hunger will persist in Minnesota. Conservatively, 10% of Minnesotans struggle with food insecurity, which is a deep problem, and it's a problem that affects more children than adults in our state. A study published by researchers at the U of M last August revealed that among people caring for children in the metro area, be their parents or aunties and uncles or grandparents, people who are caring for their kids, one of three reported some level of food insecurity. This factor carries into kids' lives and their ability to learn and thrive at school. We all know how important good nutrition is to life and learning, and we learned more about that at this hearing today. Furthermore, individual school staff should not be put in the position of deciding which children will eat and which can't. This bill is an excellent opportunity to give our state the leverage to reach kids in need. It's a win-win-win in that it finds the children in need where they are every day. It keeps kids from families that can't afford to feed them properly from being stigmatized, and it positively affects learning of our children. We know that the state budget is an issue again this session, but this bill is an opportunity to have a big payoff for a constituency whose needs we all recognize and need to prioritize, but who can't often speak for themselves, our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer. Really appreciate it. Any questions for the testifiers, members? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next in the list we have a fifth grader, Talmud, from Talmud Torah of St. Paul. Unfortunately, I was not given your name. So let's make sure that we ask you your name and introduce yourself. And then we have Jacob, a seventh grader. And then we have one more person. So I'm just going to ask you to introduce yourselves and to tell us your age and tell us the school that you come from. Okay?
I am Zachary Glazer, and I'm in fifth grade, age 10, at Talmud Torah of St. Paul.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello, I am Elias Beer, and I am also a fifth grader at Talmud Torah of St. Paul. I am aged 11.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jacob Stillman. I'm 13 years old, and I go to St. Louis Park Middle School.
Thank you. All right. You go ahead and start.
We are here to ask that you vote for the legislation that would provide free lunch to students who are in the reduced price lunch program in Minnesota. We are here to speak for the children.
I am arguing in favor of the bill because I believe that equality is not necessarily justice. Justice means that everybody gets what they need. Equality means that everybody gets the same thing. It is justice to support parents who can't afford to pay for school lunches for their children. About the bill, tax dollars would be going towards helping parents feed their children, and this would cost our state well-spent money. People are jobless, and it's very difficult for them to pay for lunches for their children. Children who have not done anything wrong are getting malnutrition because parents cannot afford breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. It will be well-spent money because we will be supporting our friends and family and saving our state money in the long run. We will be saving our state money because this bill will cost less than the money needed for medical bills caused by malnutrition in children. Imagine yourself taking turns for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with your family or missing them altogether. This is how a lot of families live. I read that Doreen Keeney, a dietitian and program director for Hunger Free Vermont, told lawmakers that they will see a greater gains in children, academic performance, attendance, and behavior if children are well fed. I agree with her. Better students lead to smarter people, which improves our country. Pass this bill to provide lunches for kids in need.
With my family, I am privileged to have a lunch every single day. Not everybody can afford the lunch, and that's the problem. A couple days ago, I was sick. I was able to join one of my classes using Skype, but because I had not very much energy, I was having trouble concentrating. Those without food have lower energy. We shouldn't have people in school who are healthy, but having trouble just because they are hungry. For those who argue this will drive up taxes, maybe you are right in the short run, but because of the education, these kids will get jobs and add to the economy, giving back what they took, probably even with a surplus. That's why I think we should feed those in need with for lunch with public money. One last thing. From Ecclesiastes, there is one verse. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you shall find it after many days. This means help others. Eventually it will come back to you. We should help these children, just like the verse says we should do.
Thank you so much. Ellie?
All right. I'm here today to urge your support for legislation that would provide free lunch to students who are in the reduced price lunch program in Minnesota. This past year, I worked with my mom to learn more about child hunger in Minnesota, including interviewing the nutrition director for St. Louis Park Public Schools. As a result, I support this legislation because I know that children's academic and social lives are affected when they do not eat lunch. Studies have shown that when children do not eat lunch, they are more likely to become aggressive and anxious. They are also more likely to not get along with other students. Lack of enough nutritious foods can interfere with a child's ability to concentrate and perform well in school. Children who struggle with hunger are sick more often, recover more slowly, and are more likely to be hospitalized. Headaches and stomach aches are also more common in children who do not eat lunch. This legislation makes sense to me because I don't like to be hungry either. I am fortunate that it is not often, I know that it is hard for me, and I can understand how it is hard for children who are often hungry because they cannot afford to pay for their lunch, even if the cost is reduced. I just feel that it isn't right for children to be hungry. When my mom and I conducted our interview, I also learned that the St. Louis Park Nutrition Department has an angel fund that they can use when they need to, but it is very limited, and I don't think that they have that in all school districts. I want your vote in favor of this legislation so that all children can have nutritious foods during the school day and focus on learning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ellie. We really appreciate that you prepare this testimony for us. I am sure that you see many of your friends. Probably you have seen somebody who really needed to have lunch and probably couldn't pay for, and they talked to you. Probably sometimes you were in a place where you forgot to pay your lunch and you really needed to eat. So we really appreciate that you took the time to prepare this to speak on behalf of so many kids like you. We need more voices like yours here because, you know, we make these decisions about everything that happens in your school. So thank you. Members, do you have any questions for the testifiers? Any comments that you wish to make? Thank you so much. Thank you. Members, a couple of issues. A couple of questions I understand that are, I'm sorry for my distraction just a few minutes ago because people apparently were wondering why we started this bill here since this has a fiscal impact. And the answer is that we wanted to give the members the opportunity to really talk about the concept in Subdivision 4, which is basically opening this conversation about who participates in the school lunch. You know, how do we address the school lunch participation, school lunch aid participation, and that is all we are doing. So, Senator Nino, I know you have the A1 amendment, and I would like to ask if there is a question I didn't know about this, but in your amendment, there is an issue about the student's family's income, which is $50,000. I was told that to make sure that I catch the fact that families of six may not qualify if we adopt this. So I didn't want to engage in the conversation about the formula because that's not under my jurisdiction. So if you don't mind, Senator, I talked to the authors about this, and they are willing to work with you and figure out how you can come together to the Senator Wigger's committee to really talk about this because I am not prepared to talk about the formula and how the income may impact participation for families. So if you're in agreement, I would like to invite you to bring this A1 amendment to the Finance Committee.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't serve on the finance. Oh, actually, I do serve on the finance. Okay, yeah, we can do that. Sorry, I'm thinking of HHS committee. I don't serve on the finance committee. I'm willing to do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
I will, if I may, just make a couple of comments.
Absolutely.
There. What precipitated the drafting of this amendment? There was a comment earlier that there are a number of families that don't sign up for the free and reduced lunch program, but they're eligible. And I'm of the opinion that there are a lot of families that are eligible that shouldn't sign up. And I use myself as an example. When I plugged my family into the formula, I can make somewhere between, depending on how you count, somewhere between $70,000 and $80,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that somebody making $70,000 a year should be getting public subsidies of any sort, really. And that's why I included that $50,000 capitation, because at $50,000, you are very much average income, middle income. And I think we need to be judicious in how we spend the taxpayers' dollars. If there's an argument to be made that there are concerns and problems that result from children not getting proper nutrition. We can look at that. But the bill is drafted really as kind of a sledgehammer when we could be using a scalpel, in my opinion. And this amendment that I won't offer it if we want to talk about that and work on it in the Finance Committee. This bill is drafted is very broad and is going to be including expenditures for a lot of families that really probably don't need it. And that was this amendment was my attempt to kind of scope that down and be more judicious with the taxpayer dollars. But I will certainly work with the authors and come back to that in another committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. And we're going to make a copy, and probably for your committee, Senator Wigger, that really talk about the guidelines. You probably will have that handout that actually, you know, a family like yours will not qualify for any subsidies anyway. But so we will have that information available in the Finance Committee. Senators, do you have any comments?
Madam Chair, I just want to say thank you. To Senator Nino, I think that is a great opportunity, and Chair Wigger's committee is to actually have the department and the folks that look at this lay out all of the guidelines, because I'm not absolutely sure. I mean, sometimes we approach it from a common sense perspective and we try to plug it in and look at various guidelines. So I think it's really good to kind of narrow the scope to those families that are in the school system and what the economic guidelines are. And that way, I think that whatever amendment or whatever we need to do to the bill to put it in shape is something that we want to do. The last thing that we want to do is to provide excess subsidies to people who don't need them. We really are absolutely hyper-focused on those who need them to make sure the children are fed and not hungry throughout the day.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. In addition to what Senator Hayden is talking about, when we want to make sure that we're currently consistent with what the guidelines are with our own state law and the food nutrition guidelines. You know, family of four, $42,000 and change. Family of six, $56,000. So we want to make sure that we're judiciously looking at those numbers to make sure that we're clear on where the bottom line is. And I know Bjorn is here that's going to be working on it as well. So, and again, I want to thank you for hearing this most important piece of legislation in front of this body, and I thank you for taking our testimonies today.
Thank you, Senators. Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate very much the work you've done on this. One question I have, I know that there is a professional organization of school nutrition people. I'm just wondering if you consulted that group to get a recommendation or their support. I'd appreciate just hearing that.
Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, the answer, Allison Bradford actually was the state chair for 5 years of that organization, and that's where it all started from. And when you look at the history of this bill, when legislative Representative Jerry Newton began this like 4 years ago, all those players were part of that conversation and discussion and saw that same gap, Senator Clausen. So.
Thank you. Any more questions, Senators? Thank you. So I am going to move these bills separately to be referred to the Finance Committee, and then you can continue to work and see how these bills come together. So I need somebody to move them, actually. I cannot move them. So, Senator.
Madam Chair, I have a question. We're talking about finances here, and I have a problem with some of the policy that we've talked about here of turning away children. And I don't think there's a question that a lunch is important, and that's a different issue than who pays for it. But I think that we really need to make sure that no kid is turned away, and whatever that takes, because we've had testimony here about, you know, what it does to the mind and what it does to learning and all of that sort of thing. And that's really important. But, we're dealing with the finances of turning someone away. And it seems to me that what we need to do is if there's collection that needs to be done differently, if there's some other practice that needs to happen, that we should do that. But we shouldn't be turning people away from lunch. So, I don't exactly know how to address that in your bill, but we definitely should not be turning anyone away who has not brought their money or has not brought their lunch or does not qualify for it.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, you know, I think you do raise an issue. I think what our attempt, if I may, with this bill is to remove the turning away of children for the reduced portion or for the reason that they qualify for a reduced lunch and don't have their money. I think that that was the scope of what we were thinking, because we think that that is the kind of primary reason why some districts are having these alternative policies or turning children away. I think that that is another conversation that maybe is a little outside of this bill, and I'd welcome and would welcome either amending this bill at the appropriate time, or even better yet, maybe a more thorough discussion in this committee about turning children away for whatever reason. But in this particular case, it was really focused on the issue of reduced lunch, and I think that's where we would hope to keep this bill. But I do think it is a conversation. I don't serve on the education committee, but that this thoughtful body might want to take up about what is school policies, period.
Thank you, Mayor Chair.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Carlson, I completely agree with you, and I think that's really the reason we wanted to start the conversation here. As a concept, you know, I always talk about building equality, and you know, one of the reasons I ran for office was to come here and try to influence that process. And I was trying to put together the numbers, and I was going to talk about really what it costs to live in Minneapolis and rent an apartment for in Minneapolis. And I started adding the numbers, but I thought, you know, I'm in the finance bill, so I'm going to leave that to speak about it during Senator Wigger's committee, because we really need to talk about how outdated these actual formulas are when we talk about a family of four that makes $40,000. I mean, if you think about, you know, what it means to rent an apartment in Minneapolis that is on average $1,200, if you're lucky to find, you know, an apartment of two rooms, if you have, you know, two kids, you need two rooms. And then utilities bring that up, and now that gas is so expensive and groceries are going up. So I'm trying to add the numbers and just to really, you know, have a conversation about what it means to make $40,000 if you are a family of four today, and how, you know, being the wealthiest nation in this planet really forces to think about whether or not we can give a kid a lunch that costs $3 or $4 in the school. So that's kind of the conversation we want to have here. And then we will move into the financial pieces, which are much more complicated, because that means how are we going to pay for that? So, Senator Dahl, do you have a question, or would you like to move the bills?
I'll move the bills. Would you like to move one at a time or both together?
Could you please move Senator Hoffman's first and then Senator Hayden?
Well, Madam Chair, I move Senate File 38 be approved and referred to the Finance Committee.
On that motion, those in favor signify by saying yes.
Yes. Yes.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator?
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 146 be approved and referred to the Finance Committee.
On that motion, all of those in favor signify by saying yes.
Yes.
Those opposed say no. Motion approved. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you.
Senators, that concludes the business of the day, and with this we will adjourn.